Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
And what sort of good employee of the IRR would I be if I didn't invite, as the first guest of 2025, my esteemed boss, Dr. John Endres, who has also been cavorting in the green fields of the Eastern Cape, to look at the year ahead. John, welcome to Hi FM 2025. Rain in Johannesburg, what can I say?
Thank you, Sarah. I'm honored to be your first guest of the year, and good to be with the Hi FM audience again.
Super. John, we had our first meeting, staff management meeting yesterday at the office, and it was a fairly low-key affair given the fact of the start of the year and everyone was looking sort of, full of the joys of New Year relaxation. And we were talking about some of the issues that we would be looking at this year and anticipated being very busy for us and for a whole lot of other people. And one of the first issues, of course, is it will be the year of Trump. How do you see the effect he will have? What some of the choices he's made, and whether he will make the real difference I think people are hoping for after a Biden administration?
I think it's maybe quite risky to try to interpret what a Trump presidency will bring, because part of his brand, I think, is the strategic ambiguity and uncertainty that he introduces to policy situations, for example, or to international relations. And so much as we might want to take our guidance from his first presidency, 2017 to 2020, and from his statements on the campaign trail, maybe some of his staff picks, I think we're still going to be in for some surprises. So as much as we know he likes the idea of tariffs and protectionist policies, he might not go that far down that route, because I think he's also promoting the idea of tariffs as a way of pressuring his trade counterparts. So a lot of this, I think, is bluster to some extent, and probably the attempt to form negotiations even before entering into them, to shape them.
Perhaps particularly, I'm thinking his byline should be something like, be prepared to be surprised. But
yes.
One of the things that that we're concerned about is obviously what effect he will have on South Africa, because he's very clearly known, as he is on most things, not to be a fan of South Africa and the South African government and its position on the world stage and its alliance with what essentially are considered enemies of the United States. And in particular, the fact that we now have COSATU welcoming the extension of the AGOA, African Growth and Opportunities Act, the re-extension to South Africa, and COSATU has been lauding the fact that the benefits it will continue to provide, and hopefully new benefits to various sectors of the economy, particularly agriculture, and. That's certainly, this is what has now happened under the Biden administration. But Trump being Trump, I mean, even AGOA is particularly, despite having been safer than it should for an ANC government, may not be safe for very long.
Mm. So our esteemed colleague Michael Morris once applied the word indelicate to another colleague's writing, which I thought was a wonderfully diplomatic way of saying that. It was being quite rude. And we can probably also apply that to Mr. Trump. So I think he has a certain air of indelicacy about him. And if it were up to him alone, mm-hmm. I think we'd get far more radical policy than we are likely to get in the end, because, of course, he doesn't call all the shots by himself. There's also Congress involved. There's the entire administration that's involved. And so he'll probably go a bit more to the extremes than actual actions in the end would seem to indicate. However, there's one intriguing possibility that I'm interested in, which is that Mr. Trump might push to redefine the U.S. relationship with South Africa to be one that is adversarial rather than one based on seeking partnership.
Mm.
So I think all the American administrations since 1994, since the transition, have treated South Africa as an important partner, as an ally, maybe a sometimes uncertain ally. given its close relationship with China, Russia, Iran, etc. But Mr. Trump might say, look, you know, we're actually pussyfooting around the issue. And as a matter of fact, South Africa is not a partner of ours. South Africa is hostile to our interests. Mm-hmm. It aligns most closely with parties that are hostile to interest. And it is time to put that fact clearly out there, mm-hmm. and say, you know, we're not here to play nice with you, South Africa, because we don't think that you're sort of working in alignment with our interests. So we'll declare you an adversary, mm-hmm. or an adversarial power. Mm-hmm. And shape our policy to fit that. Mm. And then again, you know, if Mr. Trump pushed for something like that, I'm sure the administration would probably try to soften that blow and sort of, you know, find some policies that are not quite as extreme as that might sound. But nonetheless, that would be a breath of fresh air, I think, in the diplomatic relationship, one that would not be entirely to the pleasure of the South African government, of course. Mm.
Well, it raises a variety of interesting issues that we'd have to look at in more detail at a later stage. But from South Africa's point of view, it's so-called non-aligned foreign policy, which is seen to be very aligned to very much the arch dictatorships of the world, or similar, and very critical of the West, despite the fact that South Africa benefits from its relationships with the West economically. And the fact that I think two issues. The one is that the Middle East is in huge flux. So a lot of those countries and regimes which South Africa does support, their status, one wouldn't have thought a year ago, would be anything as unsure as it is now. And you've also got the fact that China's economy is, you know, it was really much, very much seen as being able to overtake the American economy, but the, you know, its setbacks, particularly with its real estate bubble, have really made a huge, have had a huge, huge impact. I mean, I saw the figure that since 2021, and that's not long ago, around $18 trillion of Chinese household wealth has been destroyed through that bubble. So wouldn't it be wise, particularly with, I think, a very unimpressive and adversarial ambassador such as Ebrahim Rasool in the States, shouldn't the government really be looking at trying to reset the relationship before Donald Trump does just what you've suggested?
Yeah, I think they are kind of trying to do that. But I think the South African government, I think, is trying to have its cake and eat it as well. Mm-hmm. So they certainly do not want to deviate from the path of close cooperation with China, Russia, Iran, etc. They want to maintain their policy stance and foreign policy. And at the same time, I don't think they want to unnecessarily antagonize the United States. So if it's possible to stay in the United States, good books, that would be ideal. That's probably what Ibrahim Rasool is going to try to do. But I don't think they will be able or willing to step away from the relationship with their historical solidarity type allies.
Mm. Mm. No, I suspect that's right. Going on to a number of topics, since this is a sort of beginning of the year potpourri of issues we need to look at. And given the fact that we've got the 2026 local elections coming up in South Africa next year, and extremely important elections, particularly because they govern the local polity. They are about municipalities of different descriptions, and they are largely in dire straits. The ANC, we all observed in our discussions on our holidays that in traveling through the country, we have come across municipalities that are beyond terrible, and others that really appear to be clean, appear to be working, appear to be attracting possibly some investment. But in all honesty, if they don't do something with Joburg, I don't see their fortunes being very, very, very much favored in this next election. What can the ANC possibly do about municipalities in general and Joburg in particular that would stave off a possible real collapse in next year's elections?
Very tricky, especially here in Johannesburg. I think the challenges are vast, and probably many of the listeners, if they've been traveling over the Christmas period, Coming back into Johannesburg, we'll probably have observed what I also saw, which is that, and of course you knew this before you left, but
when you come back, yeah.
Yes, and you've been somewhere, where there's not so many potholes or the streetlights work or the robots work. And you come back to Johannesburg and you think, like, this is the economic powerhouse of the country. This is sort of the brashest and boldest city in South Africa. And it's dark, it's dingy, it's overgrown. I mean, there's been lots of rain as well. But the city is really not presenting itself in its best light at the moment. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of a mischievous side of me that thinks that, at some stage, Johannesburg will have to be evacuated. Mm-hmm. Just because it is so dependent on the infrastructure working, especially in terms of water. It doesn't have enough water of its own. It has to bring it from a long distance away. If that stops working, then there's a real problem in maintaining such a large population here. 5 million people in Johannesburg, 4 million Ekurhuleni, another 4 million in Tshwane. So a lot of people crammed in a small area who are dependent on the infrastructure working. And if it doesn't, then there's going to be a real problem. And that is where I think the greatest challenge for the ANC lies, or for the city government, which is to figure out a way to get on top of the declining infrastructure. Mm. There have been many turnaround plans. Clearly, they haven't worked. And part of the problem here is that the sort of more advanced technical and engineering ability you need to fix and maintain, say, water and electricity infrastructure is going to be far out of your reach if you are unable to do the basics right. So if you can't get a pothole fixed, you can't keep a robot working, you can't keep the verges clear of vegetation, if you can't do the basic, the easy things, which mm-hmm. basically just require manpower and some shovels and wheelbarrows, then you're not going to be able to maintain the complex infrastructure like mm-hmm. the water and electricity mm-hmm. infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So there's a problem there, and we're not seeing much, I think, in the way of a concerted effort by the ANC to do anything about this. Dada Morero, the new mayor, in a display of refreshing honesty, said that there was not much he was going to do or be able to do before the elections. That's probably true. But that also does mean that the ANC is in for a drubbing if residents link the state of their municipality to who is governing it. Mm.
Just a little side issue, because I see that Action SA leader Herman Mashaba has said that they are going to go full guns on the municipalities. Not everyone, but obviously Johannesburg is very much in its sights because it's now linked up with the ANC EFF coalition here. Might that not be shooting themselves in both their feet? Because whether things actually do happen or not depends on the ANC in that coalition doing something. So, what power or authority does the ASA have to put the necessary pressure on? I mean, surely.
Yeah, I think Action SA probably has a much stronger hand in Tshwane than in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And there, I think that if they manage to fix some of the issues, take credit for it, and they can be visibly associated with successes and that can help them in the elections. In Johannesburg, far more difficult because they're not really in a position of controlling anything, so can't take credit for improvements really. But at the same time, probably there won't be improvements. Action SA finds itself in working with a party that is itself struggling. And so it's not going to benefit them much, I think, in terms of reputational brownie points. Mm.
Just looking at an issue that I think it goes to everything that is bad about economic. I just think it's bad management. Is the issue surrounding logistics and infrastructure in this country, and particularly Transnet, because it is absolutely, the railways and the ports are our links to the outside world. If we offer any value, particularly in the light of the crisis in the Middle East, if our ports are to offer any value, it's by being properly run to take advantage of the fact that shipping still has to go around the tip of Africa to get to the rest of the world. You keep hearing comments that, things are happening and this program has been put in place and that set of lines has been awarded to private company to manage, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't get any sense as a layman, as someone out there waiting desperately to hear that things are improving, that any really meaningful public-private partnerships are happening. Is that likely to improve at all, or is the government always going to take two steps forwards with those partnerships and one step back and put forward conditions that are just not attractive to the private sector?
So I think one of the things we're seeing here is a kind of a delicate dance between Treasury and Transnet, where Transnet would very much like to have some money given to it to repair infrastructure, to get things going again. And Treasury has been quite reluctant to give that money because they say they haven't really seen a credible plan for a turnaround. Mm-hmm. And unless there's such a plan that also involves bringing in the private sector, then they would not consider this to be money that is likely to be productively used, in short. So there's that thing going on. At the same time, Transnet has been working on turnaround plans. There have been some steps towards bringing the private sector in. But as you said, this is not a smooth or a quick process. So it's moving quite slowly. And it also seems to me that it has slightly run out of steam. So it's slowed down even more than it should. So the powers that be at Transnet, at Treasury and the government, I hope will get a sense of the urgency that is required to fix things and how important it is to get the railways and the ports working again. Mm. It also reflects the point that South Africa has a pretty small domestic market. So you know, if you're a successful business in South Africa, that's nice. But really what you want to do is to be able to get into other markets as well, to export if possible. And if the rail lines, if the ports don't permit that, then you're going to be limited and constrained as a South African business. Mm. So yeah, there's very, very great interest in getting this to work. And I think that commercial pressure is going to end up having the effect of improving Transnet. Mm. Yes, I think it's going to be slower than we like, but it will improve.
Just looking at the GNU in generally this year, I mean, the ANC seems to have ended off the year believing that it basically its alliance with the Democrat with the Democratic Alliance in the GNU has been tactical and you know helped it to reset to regain its majority status in due course. First of all, probably that attitude doesn't help because it doesn't actually it shies away from actually welcoming the fact that cooperation is really what they wanted, which is maybe not what they really wanted. On the one hand, and the other hand is while it's still wedded to its sort of antagonism towards neoliberalism and capitalism and. You know, reflected by the comments from its alliance partners, COSATU and the Communist Party, it's still that absolute sort of commitment to national democratic revolution and basically a commitment to anything that happened globally in the 1960s, any processes that were followed. Its ongoing commitment to that is likely to just not give us the momentum we need to get out of this hole.
So I think in the first point, probably the DA also is in that partnership for tactical reasons. That's to be expected if you have two parties that are main political rivals, opponents, having to work together. Neither of them is going to like it. Mm. You've been fighting the other person, the other party, and trying to beat them, and now you're having to work with them. That's not easy. So I would not place too much emphasis on those statements about it only being for tactical reasons. I think that's true. But what is true in the beginning is not necessarily going to be true in the end. So it may be that after a while of working together, they figure out why they're doing it, begin to like it maybe. And it's a bit like a cop movie, where you get these two cops at the beginning of the movie being partnered up and they hate each other. And then ultimately they figure out how to work together. And maybe that's the kind of situation the DA and the ANC are in the GNU.
In our high noon, we just have to know, who's playing Gary Cooper. Just with regard to our neighbours and perhaps in particular Mozambique, where the election results have been certified in favour of Frelimo, but they've not been held to be free and fair by most observers. There have been assassinations. There have been huge amounts of violence. There's been reports of ex-South African or South African farmers leaving Mozambique area. And of course, Mozambique has also been suffering from a Al-Qaeda, ISIS-style insurgency. And I'm not sure we're hearing anything from the South African government. And I would have thought it's a real risk, both because you've got having a very unstable neighbor, and B, is the whole issue of migrancy from increased migrancy from Mozambique to South Africa, when the unemployment situation is pretty much not getting better, if not getting worse, and likely to exacerbate all those social problems that we face year in and year out in South Africa. Your view on what the ANC government has to do, the GNU has to do in dealing with countries like Mozambique, which bucked the trend of changes in support for parties in elections in last year.
Hmm. Yeah, I think South Africa's got two bad neighbors that create the bad neighborhood problem economically for the country. One is Zimbabwe, the other is Mozambique, but for very much the same reasons, which is that you have a longstanding liberation movement still running the affairs of the country and holding on to power by means legitimate and illegitimate. And that is causing a lot of not only instability, but also economic underdevelopment that, as you say, drives people to seek their fortunes in more hospitable countries like South Africa, and who can blame them? Mm. For this to be fixed, probably South Africa's government needs a readjustment, a mental readjustment. And you were asking your earlier question about the adherence of the ANC to the National Democratic Revolution, 60s-style ideology. Two reasons. One, I think, is that it's linked to its identity. So whenever you challenge a value or an ideology that somebody builds their identity on, that's going to be very difficult for them to handle. And the second thing is that it's probably still, in the eyes of the ANC, the best idea out there. Mm. If they look around and they compare it to other things, they probably say NDR is probably still an accurate analysis of historical trends. It is still a worthwhile goal to work towards, despite hiccups along the way. Mm. And some party members, I think, are much more bought into that idea than others. But the ones who are ideologically firm and principled, I think, are going to pursue the NDR and find it hard to move away from that. Mm. Another challenge, of course, with the GNU, with the DA involved.
Well, maybe the ANC should start by changing the curriculum of its political school that all the young politicians go through. John, it's going to be, as the Chinese curse says, it's going to be an interesting year for us locally, internationally, and for the IRR, and more power to everybody's elbows to come out on the other side better than we've gone in. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.